Why do good people suffer? Well, Randy. Well, good morning, everybody. So, I've done a quick test this morning. This is sort of a follow-on from my talk last year. So, who remembers my talk last year? Good. Simon failed miserably. So, format this morning, got a few slides just to sort of set the scene, probably 10, 15 minutes max, and then we'll break up into some groups and have a chat, and then perhaps after that I'll round off with a few thoughts. If anybody has any pressing questions while I'm talking, we're all friends, shout out, I'll try and answer them. So, set the scene then. We look at the whole universe and we look at ourselves very differently. We're quite happy to accept that the universe is really, really, really big. So here we have a picture of Earth, that little dot just there. That contains every person that has ever lived. It contains every war that has ever existed. It contains every worry that has ever happened. Every bit of suffering, every bit of happiness, all in that one little dot. And that little dot is part of lots of little dots. So this is each of those dots on that picture there of galaxies, which contain countless millions upon millions of stars, of which our sun is one of, and our Earth wouldn't even be visible. It's just so massive that our brains can't even contain how big the whole universe is. So the setting the scene here is to sort of put things in perspective. When we're struggling, when we've got a little bit of a worry, it's actually quite a small worry on the big scale of things. Now, that's not to undermine the problems we have or to say they're any less. It's just to say, remember that we are all part of a much bigger picture. And this bigger picture is 13 or 14 billion light years across. It's huge. And we are just a dot in that whole thing. And if we look at Earth and nature, now this sort of goes back to some things I said last year. Now, science has looked at how God created things. We have looked at why God created things. And the two can work hand in hand. And I've found personally that looking at nature and God's creative methods has helped me understand the issues around suffering. So as scientists look at nature, they see, ooh, that animal is similar to that animal. And they study that, and then they test things, and they test those tests, and other people look at those tests, and they form an opinion and a theory about how things were doing. We also know from our Bible that God speaks to us through nature, and he's told us that nature's telling you things about me. So the two can go hand in hand. And after quite a long time of looking into this prayerfully and thinking, I personally have come to the conclusion that with current knowledge and my understanding, that quite possibly got one of God's tools. He's got many tools in his toolbox. He could have used something like evolution to create the species as we know it today. Now, it creates quite a few ups and downs and question marks, but if you look into it, that's one of the theories that you can come up with, and it seems to make sense when you look at DNA evidence and stuff, and I could go into a whole long talk about that. But if you just hold that thought and think about it, through the rest of this discussion, it might help, and it certainly helps me, understand a lot more about how God works and how he allows things such as suffering, or even why suffering has to happen. So as I say, this is a follow-on from my talk last year, so I don't want that to be too much of a bombshell, but we often hear talks about the beauty of creation. In fact, that last slide is typical of that. Nice waterfalls, flowing waterfalls, pretty snails, koalas. It's all wonderful and cute. However, there is a darker side to creation. We have worms. These infest people, make them very poorly. These worms are part of God's creation. They are an animal that needs to live, needs to survive. And you look at the Bible and it talks about sparrows being of value to God. That's meaning that even the smallest insignificant creatures are of value to God in their own way. So we have a tapeworm, I think that one is. We've got a tick here, one of my least favourite creatures. Getting nasty in the New Forest. Mosquitoes are responsible for more deaths than any other animal in the world. And we've got this poor little bug here, who's currently infested with lots of little maggots that are eating it from the inside out. Now those maggots are also part of God's creation. However ugly it might seem, when we talk about the beauty and the wonder of creation, we have to accept these are also part of that beauty and wonder of creation. There is, in every one of these pictures, a story of suffering, a story of bad things happening to things that probably don't deserve it. In Isaiah 40, God says, I form the light and create darkness. I bring prosperity and create disaster. I, the Lord, do all these things. It's not from the mouth of Most High. Is it not from the mouth of Most High that both calamities and good things come? Lamentations 3. So God creates good. God creates bad. Now, evolution. That is the way that animals become better and better and better with time. Now, God, I believe, is in control of all this. It's one of his tools. And in order for things to become better, the bad, less perfect animals have to suffer. So if you've got an animal with four legs, and it can't, so if you've got an animal with multiple legs or inability to walk or whatever, in order for it to get better, it has to, over time, develop and improve. That means that the animals that didn't develop and improve have to die. Now that can work in macroevolution, where you get new species. It can also work within microevolution, which is usually a bit less contentious. And we can now see it in human history as well. In the Middle Ages, there was this thing called bubonic plague, which you've all heard of, I'm sure. Now, this was a disease that, if you got it, I'm not sure anybody in the Middle Ages survived it having caught the disease. Emma? So I'm not, but basically, it was almost certainly fatal. If you got it, you were gonna. It was highly contagious, so it would run through towns and infect everybody. It went on and on and on. Millions of people died as a result of it. But not everybody died. Now there's a few stories from the Middle Ages that show why not everybody died. In this country, there was a famous vicar or pastor, yeah, a vicar in a town in Derbyshire, who had been reading his Bible, and he thought, now we've got the plague, why don't we contain ourselves and not mix with the people around it? Because it seems that if you see somebody with a plague, they then get it. So how about we quarantine ourselves and be safe? I've read my Bible, and that's what they did with things like leprosy. So let's give this a go. And the result of that was, as that information spread across the country, more and more people were doing this quarantine thing, and the spread of plague slowed down. Another thing which helped was another immense amount of suffering. London in 16 something or other, 1665 or 1666. Yeah. Plague, is it? Thanks, Mum. Actually, Mum, do you want to? Yeah, in 1665, there was a really bad plague happening in London. People were dying everywhere. And then, during this, somebody decided to cook a piece of bread in Pudding Lane. And the whole of London went, woof, Great Fire of London. Huge amounts of suffering. However, the good that came from that suffering of the Fire of London was that bubonic plague was killed out as well. All the rats and the infestations that had caused or helped bubonic plague to carry on through stopped. So that's one story. Another story is the quarantine. And finally, not everybody who came into contact with bubonic plague got it. They maybe had better diets, better personal hygiene, from their upbringing, from just the type of people they were. And that meant that although they'd been in contact with it, they just didn't get it, and they were more healthy. Those people survived and went on to have children. And bubonic plague has been around and is still around. It wasn't until about 60 or 70 years ago that we had any proper treatment for it in the form of antibiotics. Yet it was a story from bygone years, and I believe that the huge amounts of suffering and the pain and anguish that happened through all those years created the society that had suffered from that made us better. We were less prone to it. We'd learned stories about how to stop it. We understood a bit more about personal hygiene, and all of those things helped humans in Europe to improve. Through that suffering, we became better. Natural disasters are quite hard to tackle on this. We look at earthquakes and volcanoes. Yet, without plate tectonics, there could be no life on Earth. The process of molten rock producing carbon dioxide as it spews out this molten rock, sends out carbon dioxide in massive quantities, creates a greenhouse effect. Now, if this planet didn't have a greenhouse effect that we hear so much about on eco-friendly sides, we would be a really, really cold planet. So we need that effect. We just don't need too much of it. And volcanoes help this to happen. And you look back in ancient history, and you realise that the advent of more and more activity from volcanoes helped change the atmosphere to a point where it would allow God to create life. So, with this pain and anguish of volcanoes erupting, earthquakes, come the basis that actually our planet can support life. So with pain and suffering comes the ability to exist as humans. So what I'm trying to say is set the scene here for, with every bit of pain and suffering you can see, there is an equal opposite need for that in God's plan. So I'm not saying God allows pain and suffering to exist. I'm going that step further and saying pain and suffering has to exist in order for God's plan to work. Now, we have to also accept an element of randomness in our own pain and suffering. It could be them that need to go, it could be me that needs to go. We don't understand that, but it needs to happen to somebody. There is another side to it as well. This little story here. Somebody talking to Jesus. So, why do you allow things like famine, war, homelessness, crime, starvation, disease, suffering, despair to exist in our world? And Jesus is saying back to him, interesting that you should bring that up, as I was about to ask you the same question. So, we've talked about some of the natural causes of pain and suffering and anguish. Actually, we cause more pain, suffering and anguish through our own free will than anything else. Think of all the countless millions of people who have been killed in wars that are just humans being stupid. Think of the fact that every minute or so, several children die in Africa due to starvation or related diseases. Yet, yesterday we probably threw food in the bin. So, we allow pain and suffering to exist as well. So we can put a lot of it on God and say, why do you allow it? And actually, we are allowing it. We look at tragedies that happen, the horrible famines that we've got. We look at the sad incidents at Grenfell Tower in London a few weeks ago, and how that all has come down to a little bit of greed, a little bit of ignorance, a little bit of not listening, and ultimately human nature has allowed that suffering to happen. God gave us free will and said, love one another as I have loved you, and left us free on that. So, there's a film that I really enjoyed and think, although it's funny, is actually quite profound. It's a film called Bruce Almighty. Now, Bruce is going through lots of suffering in his life, and he basically challenges God and says, why are you doing this to me? And is really angry with God. And the story goes that God comes to him and says, okay, you try and do better then. And he gives Bruce powers, as God has, to do anything he wanted. But he does give him one rule, which is free will is essential. You can't make somebody love you. The story is quite funny, but it shows Bruce getting to all kinds of pickles trying to use God's power inappropriately. One that I remember is that to try to woo his girlfriend and make her love him, he made the moon a little bit bigger, brought it a bit closer to Earth, and that created flooding everywhere, because obviously the tides were massive and there was massive amounts of suffering as a result of what he did. He also allowed everybody to win the national lottery, which when spread out along the countless thousands of tickets meant that everybody won about half a penny each. And there was riots and suffering as a result of that. So there is a fine balance in all of creation, in all of human free will, that means that actually suffering is necessary. So we've got some time now to have a bit of a chat. Now, I'm not sure how you've usually broken up. Do you break up into groups, or do you? Yeah. So, what I would like you to do is, I would like you to think about a disaster or a problem or two, and think about how that is God's will, how that suffering is necessary. Now, for example, I've already talked about Grenfell Tower being actually a picture of human greed, human nature being a failure. But we can look at the plague as well. Terrible diseases about how humans or the necessary stuff from God has caused that. Murders, earthquakes, volcanoes. Just have a think about, in the groups, about how that has been done by God and how it is necessary for the future. Because we know that all things are for God and are working towards his big plan. So any problem that we have, any incident that happens, is part of this big picture. Now, I've said it initially, it's a very big picture, but in our lives, it's quite significant. So you can either, you can think about that, or you can try and do better, and you can follow the rules. Free will is essential, so you can't make people make the right choices, they have to make the right choices themselves. And life has to thrive, so things have to improve, and humans and animals have to improve with time. So, do you want to split up into groups?